Hello, and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward's School Birmingham and King Edward's High School for Girls. Today is a slightly different format because it's our first panel discussion. I'll introduce our panellists in a second, but my name is Ben Anderson. I left King Edward School in 2006 and pursued a career in the arts, now work in podcasting, and I'm absolutely delighted to have been asked by King Edwards to produce the series for them. As you know, we usually do interviews, but today it's a panel discussion with three old Edwardians where the focus is on our response to COVID, not from the medical perspective, but from a societal point of view. I'm joined today by Alexa Joyce, Education and Skills Director for the Microsoft Corporation, responsible for Europe, the Middle East and Africa. Malcolm Waugh, OBE, Chair of CNI Scotland, with 25 years of experience in the defence and security industry. And Hermine Graham, Clinical Psychologist, who's on the UK Advisory Board for Safer Gambling. Alexa, can we start with you? Would you mind telling us a little bit about you? And obviously, if I've missed anything from your biography, please do fill us in.
Thanks, Ben. It's really great to be here with you today. I'm really excited to be sharing some of my experience and remote and hybrid learning during the COVID pandemic with folks from King Edwards. So my background, I actually, after leaving King Edwards, went to study biology, and in a bit of an unusual career path move, I then ended up in the technology industry, mainly because I was really interested in how could we teach science using technology and enable more people to access science and technology education in ways which were more engaging and more rewarding for students. So that brought me actually into the technology industry, and I've been working in Microsoft for 6 years in the education team. And that means doing an awful lot of work around science, technology, engineering and maths and computer science education. But obviously, since the pandemic, all of us have been working really, really hard to support schools, teachers, students, ministries of education in thinking about how do they actually ensure that learning continues despite the fact that we're in lockdown or semi-lockdown, using remote and hybrid approaches to ensure that learning carries on.
Alexa, thank you. Malcolm, welcome to the panel. Could you tell us a little bit more about your experience?
Well, again, thank you very much for inviting me at quite a critical time. I've had quite an eclectic life, I suppose. I decided to join the Navy before I went to university, partly because the Navy paid me to go to university, which was a handy thing to do. And in the 25 years I was in the Navy, in submarines, actually, in the Cold War, I think I went to about 60 or 70 countries around the world for various reasons. And after that, and in fact, during that, I had some exciting times in a submarine fire, which is a crisis. In Phnom Penh, I was on the last aircraft out of Phnom Penh when the revolution took place. I came back from the Falklands and interviewed the Conqueror, for those who know that. And then when I left, I joined a big corporate organization. I was in Rwanda during the genocide, subsequently saw some cholera outbreaks and so on and so forth. And now I try and do nothing at all, which isn't quite my personality. So I'm pretty occupied on COVID, lessons identified, and I have a pretty strong team across the world, including some old Edwardians. And what we're trying to do is to pull together some of the disparate threads of what's been going on with COVID-19. And as Alexa said, for the long-term look.
Thank you ever so much. And Hermine, thank you also for joining us on the panel.
Thank you so much, Ben, for having me. Interested and excited to be involved in this. So my background is I'm a clinical psychologist, and I worked for 25 years in the NHS, and also for part of that time also worked at the University of Birmingham. And I've specialised in the research and treatment of mental health problems and substance misuse. And I've been particularly interested in looking at the relationship between people's mental health and their use of alcohol and drugs, and cognitive therapy, really, or behavior therapy, as people commonly refer to it, this idea about the relationship between the way we think, our thinking style, and our emotional difficulties that we might experience, and looking at treatments, evaluating treatments that are effective in treating things like anxiety, depression, or more severe mental health problems, and also treating substance misuse when it co-occurs.
Thank you ever so much. And as we briefly discussed before we clicked the record button today, The reason that we wanted to do this today is because old Edwardians will be listening, but also a lot of the students who are current students at both the boys and girls school will be listening to this podcast. There's still a lot of fear around, and I think the fear has shifted slightly. I'm using my own personal experience here, but of course, when something like this first happens, you're scared with the health implications of what it might mean for you and your family. But as we get deeper into living with COVID, the fear kind of slightly shifts to what does the future hold? How long will this go on for? And I think today I'd really like to discuss those elements with the aim of kind of giving people who are listening a greater understanding about what's happening around them, and so they can be better informed going forward. To start off, of course, COVID-19 is a global pandemic, but I'd like to focus most of our discussion on the UK's response to coronavirus. How prepared can a country be? And I think, Malcolm, this might be best directed to you. How prepared can a country be for a situation like COVID-19? Of course, there have already been plans in place in terms of how our government would deal with a health pandemic. But how detailed can you be in that planning if you don't know the details of the problem?
OK, I think there's probably three parts to that equation. And clearly there's boundaries. The boundaries between each part is blurred. But if I take a practical situation, a submarine, for example, what you do in a submarine, which I tell you has lots of crises involved with them, is you train people, you make them aware, and then you work them up together, and then you learn lessons from it. And those three parts are pretty vital. So if we take certainly our analysis of COVID-19, clearly some parts of the community have handled the situation better than others. That's partly due to age, experience, background, and so on and so forth. What we haven't done potentially is work people up together in that sense. We've tended to stovepipe people. So we've had the medical people and the business people and other so-called experts. So that is a missing ingredient. And then I think the third thing is really important for us all to grasp, is it isn't about what happens right now. We're in the middle of it. It's how we're going to deal with the next one. And there will be further ones. And what we learn from this and how we take that forward is really fundamental. Doubtless there are certain elements of the society who've been used to dealing with the crisis, not just the medical profession, by the way. The fire service, other blue light services are quite used to this sort of thing, and they can show some leadership. I also think that young people have come up, and I've seen some really fantastic examples of young people. This is their first serious international crisis, and they've come up with some amazingly great innovative ideas of how we can to use those, but they tend to have been dismissed because governments are not necessarily good at understanding the complexity of dealing with a crisis. They're not particularly set up that way either. And one of the issues we might have to look at is what is the composition of the top leadership team when we hit a crisis of this nature? Do we need to have every politician deciding they should lead it, or should there should be other experts, including, I might say, some young people in that particular mix?
Of course, we all look to government in times of crisis. We look to strong leadership. Do you think that in comparison, because there were countries like Germany and South Korea that were hitting the headlines a lot at the beginning for their fabulous, apparently, response to the pandemic, how did we compare as the UK?
Well, I've been fortunate to meet quite a lot of world leaders. I've met, I think, five American presidents and half a dozen prime ministers, and one or two others who stand out, including an old Edwardian, Field Marshal Lord Slim, who I think was an outstanding leader. And the better ones are good at communicating, and the better ones are good at delegating, and the better ones are good at listening. And those are probably the three characteristics you need. And probably there's an additional one which hasn't come out, and I've seen this in practice, is when you're trying to lead something like this, you often have to make decisions without all the evidence available to you. And that's actually a very difficult thing to be able to do. You have to have the confidence, but the awareness to do that. So those, I think, are the four characteristics of patch you need. And there are some outstanding old Edwardians who actually display those characteristics. And maybe we should lean on their history in a few examples.
Speaking of communicating, we've had many messages from our government over the last few months. Do you think that the government has been successful in their messages to the public, adapting when needed, or are you as confused as I am?
I found in crises I've been involved in is you need to keep a very simple message. needs to be a powerful message. It needs to be a message which can be articulated at different levels, but it needs to be kept simple. And then maybe you need to add to that because people get fed up with the same old messaging. So, for example, in a forum I was dealing on COVID, we talked about the survivability onion the other day. It happened to be in an African forum. So I think the answer, straight answer to your question, is we've made it far too complicated. I mean, I sit there and scratch my head thinking, what advice should I now be following? Should I be following the Scottish government, the UK government, the World Health Organization, the expert from RUSI, whatever. Very confusing. So keeping the messaging simple, straightforward, and indeed repeating it is a good idea. And the BBC has a role to play in that. And I'll stop there.
I mean, in terms of a society, these clear, supposedly clear messages are supposed to help us as a society to tackle the coronavirus. How does this affect the individual in terms of their mental health when we are receiving so many different messages in quite a short space of time?
I think that people respond differently, don't they? And the idea that there's a singular response as individuals is really not the case, that different people respond differently to an event. And the idea is that, particularly within cognitive therapy, is that it's the meaning that we attach that will determine then how we will respond. So the initial kind of response, as you said, to hearing about the virus, people were posed with a kind of threat, something unexpected. Their subsequent responses really vary, don't they? So for some people, this is going to exacerbate underlying feelings of fear and anxiety about the world being an unpredictable and unsafe place. It evokes feelings of loss, losing jobs, losing an opportunity at school, an opportunity to sit exams, an opportunity to meet with their friends at school. So some of the children at Keswick and the girls' school might have felt those feelings. But those who started to kind of question and think, well, what if I catch the virus? What if I die? Then they started to experience anxiety and fear. For people who started to experience real sense of loss of the life and how it was previously, they start to experience depressive symptoms. And typically those who start to say, you know, for example, the Chinese government should have controlled this. It should never have been allowed to get out of control. The British government should have done X, Y, and Z. Then they start to feel quite angry. And so what we're finding is very different responses to different people. For some people, they already had pre-existing mental health or emotional difficulties, and it's caused those difficulties to come to the fore. But however, there are other groups, I think Malcolm kind of alluded to these groups, who have responded to this in quite a different way and have adjusted to it and seen it as an opportunity. So as opposed to feeling locked in and locked down, they've seen it as an opportunity to unlock new potential and new opportunities. So I think that this idea of a singular response leads us down a kind of a path of thinking people should respond in a particular way, whereas actually people respond in a variety of different ways and have done.
It's interesting you say that. And Alexa, I'd love to come back to that in a second with you in terms of how technology is helping us unlock new opportunities. Just before we do move on from this, Malcolm, I read an article, I think it was back in April, from an American newspaper that was talking about the UK's response to coronavirus. And they said that it wasn't purely a medical response in the sense of this is the physical effects that coronavirus will have on our society and this is how we deal with it. Apparently, they took a more behavioural approach. Is that something that you've heard? Is this a rogue article that I read and it stuck in my mind? Or did the UK government look at the behaviour of a nation and implement some of those learnings into the initial response?
I've never read the same article, and the straight answer is yes, actually. And I think what is interesting is that hasn't come over particularly well to the population at large. And as we've just heard, is that the population responds differently depending on your experience and the way of your thinking. And behaviour is a really important aspect of the whole thing. I mean, certainly in crises I've been, I'm looking out for how people have behaved or are likely to behave in those circumstances. And the interesting feature is that some people rise right above it you might not actually know that they do that, and others don't. It's really quite a complex area of activity. I'm not a psychologist, but it's a really, the answer to your straight question is yes, the government did, and governments around the world, particularly in New Zealand, have indeed used behaviour as part and parcel of their decision-making process.
Hermine, if everybody's response is so different, how can you possibly create a model that involves everyone?
I think that the initial messaging that you described that the government put out was very much a collective message, wasn't it? So it was kind of very much created a mindset of we're all in this together. So it was this very singular, very simple message. And so people had limited choices. And so we were all told we needed to stay in and we needed to act in a particular way. And so it was very clear that what was required. So there were limited choices. And so people were kind of funneled into a way of thinking. And I think that I know that a lot of behavioral scientists have been advising the government on the initial strategy around kind of compliance with the measures to reduce infection rates. I think subsequent messaging became much more kind of nuanced and took on a much more individualized approach. And with that comes so many choices and pathways people can go down. And so what you get is very individualized responses to that. And it's very hard to control that. However, I do think that within a lot of the modeling that was done, the statistical modeling, that there was account taken for the fact that actually once you go on to a much more nuanced approach, that you're going to get reduction in compliance because you're going to get more individual choices. It's very difficult to get people to all take the same approach when you're giving them a number of choices. If the choices are limited, people are more likely to comply.
I'd like to move on now. Alexa, thank you so much for joining us today. So you're Education and Skills Director for the Microsoft Corporation. And of course, we've all had to adapt our lives this year and live in this new normal. Alexa, could you tell us about the changes that you've seen in terms of how quickly businesses, organisations, schools, charities, how we've all had to adapt to technology in order to stay connected and to keep things moving?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's been pretty mind-blowing what's happened from a technology standpoint since the beginning of the pandemic. And what our CEO, Satya Nadella, has been saying is that what we've seen across every industry, every area of work that we support, which is pretty much every part of society, we've seen more transformation from a technology standpoint since the beginning of the pandemic than we have in the prior 10 years. So there's been this enormous acceleration in the usage of technology. And even where I live in the countryside, just outside Brussels, you see small shops that before would only accept cash payments moving to having online ordering and digital payment and home delivery services. So from the smallest company to the largest company, there's been a really profound digital transformation. And this has created a huge change even in the job market and in what we need to learn and what we need to study. So what we've seen as a result is that there's been the existing gap in terms of digital skills that are out there in the UK, but also across the world, has just really been accentuated. And there's a huge growth in demand for people who've got the ability to combine digital skills with subject domain knowledge. So whether you're a health IT expert, whether you're an education IT expert, all of these different areas suddenly have a much more profound need for somebody who can really understand what they're trying to do and the role that technology has to play in enabling them to work at distance and to keep social distancing happening. So there's been this really significant change in how we work and how we need to orient ourselves from an employability standpoint. And so we see across the world, almost every single government that I'm working with is looking into how they can accelerate digital skilling programs, whether it's for people who are older people at home who may not have had the opportunity to learn about technology at school or from their peers or from their children. right through to how do we actually rethink what types of digital skills we bring into primary and secondary education so that we make the education process itself more equitable in terms of digital skill acquisition as well. And I think the latter point is super important because there's a lot of assumption that young people are just brilliant at technology. And I was just on a call this week with the Global Alliance for Youth with students and apprentices from around the world. And they were telling us that actually they saw even within their own generation, huge digital skills gaps, that the more well-off, the well-resourced families really set their children up well to be successful with technology, to use technology in a productive way. And that those young people who didn't come from such privileged backgrounds were really struggling to use technology in a productive way and became instead more of a digital distraction. And there's a distinct difference in the way that different social classes use technology, in that typically those who come from less privileged backgrounds will spend much more time using technology for entertainment purposes and don't necessarily have the skill sets or the support to be able to use technology more productively and more effectively.
I'm just going to add to that in the sense that I'm a technology geek, as all my friends tell me. I've got so many Raspberry Pis that it's beyond, it's really sad. But I think there are two additional points here. I have a twin brother who's suffering quite badly mentally during this. He hasn't got a computer. He's never going to have a computer. And we do have to be aware of the many people in the population who are not digital savvy. And I think the other point, just to touch on, is there's quite a lot of security implication, as Alexa will invariably know, around the new society, which we're developing very quickly, that we need to consider and home in on. But it's the first one that worries me. We're in danger of dropping off a segment of the population who we need to take along in this new digital society we live in.
I think that's a great point, Malcolm, and I've really noticed the difference in terms of how different countries have responded to this. So I work quite a lot with the Finnish system, and particularly from an education perspective, it was really interesting to hear from them that they had much less trouble that switching to digital learning than we had in the UK, because they have very strong social provision of technology to households. So they didn't have that set of socially excluded families and households and people who didn't have access to technology in the same way that we've seen in the UK. I've heard about cases in the UK where parents were literally choosing between buying a top-up data card versus going out and buying food for the household so that students can continue learning during the lockdown. And that shouldn't be happening anymore in the UK from my perspective, when we see that neighbours not that far away in Europe are able to put in place programmes that can address that type of challenge. And so I think when we look also to other countries like Estonia, who consider internet access a human right, I think in the UK, we should be looking at some of these types of approaches and adopting those in our own systems.
As Malcolm was saying about his brother, though, it's not just about access to technology, of course, is it? It's the individual. I mean, you know, I think we all did spend quite a lot of time trying to teach our parents and grandparents how to use FaceTime or WhatsApp video call. But I mean, can you, Alexa, can you teach an old dog new tricks? You know, can we expect that, I mean, as you say, you know, there's a gap in the younger generations, but I think you automatically think of the older generation when you think about digital transformation and leaving them behind. I mean, how easy is it going to be to educate those parts of our population?
Well, I have a personal example, which was my grandfather actually got online when he was 90. So I think it just goes to show that it is possible at any age. Now, I think that the challenge is that you have to build in the support structures that enable that to happen. And some people will have that support from their family, but there will also always be a portion of people who don't. So you need to think about ways to ensure maybe nonprofit organizations or volunteering programs are there so that younger people can come in and help and support those who are digitally excluded. And at the same time, that type of process helps to generate job opportunities for young people, because they tend to be more digitally fluent, more able to be trained to give that type of support. And it's also a mutually rewarding social experience often to build build those types of generational bridges. And I've even seen that type of approach being taken in schools in some parts of the world where I've worked, for instance, in Malaysia, where they were putting technology into classrooms and teachers were just not really ready to do it in ways that were meaningful. So they actually created a tech support system where the girls in the school were actually the tech support team. It was an all-girls school as well. The girls in the school were the tech support team for the teachers, which I thought was a fascinating way to do it. And they then also engaged the students in the decisions about what kinds of technology the school needed and needed in the classroom. So it was really an empowering process to have the students in the school really part of the change and the implementation of the change in terms of technology.
Hermine, in terms of how, obviously there's lots of different effects that digital transformation can have, but just focusing on the speed at which this has happened and, well, been forced because of COVID-19, what mental health effects can that have on the individual?
Okay, so I guess the idea of being forced to communicate in that way suggests the negative connotation, doesn't it? That we're kind of, there's no other choice. And as Malcolm said, you know, his brother has, in a sense, has chosen not to. So there are people who, you know, will opt out of that. I think that it's a medium, and Alexa knows more about this than I do, that in a sense works well for some people, and some people have found it a much more positive medium to work through, and it has unlocked a lot more opportunities for them to work with and collaborate with people in a range of different ways. But for other people, I think that it's been quite difficult, because particularly if you're somebody who's very socially oriented, then it reduces the opportunities for social interactions. If you're somebody who, you know, benefits from an external structure, whereas now we have to impose a structure on ourselves. And so I think it's impacted people quite differently.
Absolutely. And I think that what we've learned a lot from this period is about also the structures and constraints that have been imposed by the technology and the technology platforms that we use, as well as the opportunities that they give. So I think one of the things that's been really striking for me when I've learned from our research teams in Microsoft is that just how tiring, how much cognitive load comes from interacting with other people, each limited to this tiny little box. So I can't see all of your physical unspoken language. I can't measure exactly how you're responding to what I'm saying. So even if I like this medium, there's a limit to that unspoken communication and my ability to gauge that, which is really challenging for anyone to deal with. And we found that working or learning all day in this type of environment is really challenging for most people. And so we've actually been experimenting on the engineering side at Microsoft to new forms of interfaces that enable more rich social engagement. And so now on Teams, you can switch onto together mode, which actually visualizes people together in a physical space. And we found that by using that mode, first of all, people become much more human again, become much more informal in the way that they interact online. But also, it's much less tiring for people to participate in an online meeting or lesson or seminar than it is in a traditional everyone in the small box type of design. And we've also seen some amazing stuff going on with children. And I observed it even with my own son, who've been connecting through gaming platforms as a way to keep connected from a social perspective. And at Microsoft, Minecraft Education Edition is our educational version of the popular game. And my son was using that during the lockdown to explore the International Space Station built in the Minecraft world. And then he would invite his best friend in to join him in that Minecraft space. And they would have Skype running in the background so they could talk to each other about what they wanted to build and how they could work together. And it was really fascinating to see that they were actually doing something educational, something literally constructive. And at the same time, their level of excitement and exchange and the way that they were communicating was much more like the way that I hear them communicating when they're playing. So it was really an eye-opener for me to see that, you know, that research evidence that I've read about the value of gaming in education actually coming into real life in front of me in my own home during the lockdown period that we had here.
Just going back to the Teams development, I know how to do audio. I'm an audio guy. I'm a Luddite with everything else. What do you mean by this new mode, like in terms of what does it look like? How does that work?
Yeah, so well, when you're in the Teams environment, you can look in your options and you'll see you should have the preview of this together mode. And the first version that we've released actually looks like a lecture theatre. So it basically cuts out all of our heads and sticks us sitting in seats as if we were sitting next to each other in a lecture theatre. But on the next release, there's going to be additional versions where you could be sitting together in a forest or other types of environments as well. So it's kind of funny how actually switching to a traditional visualization of what learning looks like has been the one which is actually easier for people to interact with and has generated more engagement. So I'm really looking forward to actually how people start to respond to some of these other types of environments that get released in a couple of months' time.
Hi, I'm Sanam.
And I'm Betty, and we've been fundraising in support of the Assisted Places Scheme across each school. What's that, you ask?
The Assisted Places Scheme aims to provide access to excellence for all. So if you want to make a change,
start small and support the campaign. Thank you.
I'd like to talk now specifically about young people. Malcolm, you mentioned this before we started recording about how you wanted to talk about resilience today. Because we are being told constantly that this is the new normal. We're going to be living with COVID-19 for potentially quite a long time. What message is it that you would like to give to the younger generations when it comes to resilience and dealing with what we're dealing with at the moment around us?
Okay, well, one of the things I also do is I do some work for Founders for Schools, which is essentially young people from age 7 upwards. Obviously, individuals are very different, but what young people are about is the thirst for knowledge, many of them. They want to know about things. They want to learn about things. So there's a real obligation on people who are older than them to give them good mentoring. And that isn't just purely about education. It's about explaining to them things which worry them, explaining to things that they can do for the rest of society, explaining things that they can do in the future for the benefit of themselves and society.
I think there are a number of things. I think that as humans, we're very flexible and can adjust very well, in the right environment, given the right kind of support. And I think that things that are really important to help people adjust are things like social support, having good routines, finding meaning and value and purpose in the everyday. And I think that that's going to become more and more important. The messages about that life, I think previously perhaps we messaging was about that life is, there is a normal life and that there are some things that are certain, whereas actually the messaging now needs to be about actually life can be very unpredictable at times, bad things happen, but that we can adjust and grow from them. And so I think it's maybe messaging to particularly children and young people that, yes, life as we expected it to be has shifted, but that doesn't mean that life has ended and that actually we can kind of almost like if we think of waves on the ocean, we can, a surfer sees a wave and thinks, I'm going to surf this. Another person will stand at the front of the shore and think, oh, my goodness, this is a tsunami. It's going to overtake me. And so the messaging we want to give is that actually life is full of those ups and downs like a wave, and we can surf those waves and that we can deal with the uncertainty that life brings. And I guess it's about finding some internal compasses, identifying our values and the meaning we attach to life that kind of guides us, because sometimes society can't give us those external cues that guide the kind of path of our lives.
So you're saying that we can teach resilience, because resilience feels like a kind of fundamental, is it part of who you are, or is it something that you learn? Is it nature? Is it nurture?
That's a really good question. I don't think the research is definitive on that. I think it's a bit of both, perhaps. That we can teach people resilience. We can kind of give messaging, particularly to, and I think that children are much more resilient than we realize they are. Because if you think about, the changes children go through at quite important developmental points. They go from being with their primary caregivers to being then, for example, at nursery or school, cared by people who are strangers to them, and they adjust to that. Children may lose parents or lose family members, but they somehow adjust if they're given the right messaging. So I think that a supportive environment is really key. We find also that children who go through adverse life experiences, that a number of them will go on to experience significant mental health difficulties, drug or alcohol problems, may get involved in the criminal justice system. But there are also children who go through those same experiences and somehow have post-traumatic growth and are quite resilient and bounce back and flourish. And so I think that resilience is something that we can teach. And I think that messaging is really, really important. The meaning we attach to things that happen are really important. If I see an event as happening as global, as never changing, as an uncertainty, as a terrible thing, then it's going to be very hard for me to change. Whereas if I see an event as temporary, as uncertainty, as part of life, and that actually in spite of difficulties, there is still hope and I can still find meaning, then I have a very different outcome.
And I think there's a really important role for schools here too. Many school systems that I'm working with are putting a really big focus on social and emotional learning and attitudinal and behavioural approaches to success. And I think that when we look at some of the work that's been done by people like Carol Dweck around the growth mindset, where the idea is to encourage children and people more broadly to shift thinking from thinking I have a set of specific fixed capabilities or skills or attributes, and to thinking that actually through practice, through effort, through new ways of approaching things, I can use opportunities that may on the surface look difficult as opportunities to drive that growth and evolution facing those types of difficult circumstances. And when it comes to learning, we often say within the education sector that emotion is the gateway to cognition, because if you're in a state of fear, if you're in a state of anxiety, it's very hard to learn. You're distracted. You're in a state of stress, which doesn't enable you to really engage and to play with concepts and to rethink things and to be creative and to be social in the way that you're learning. So helping students and young people to be resilient, there's an awful lot of research that shows that by helping develop the attitudes and behaviors that support resilience and support social and emotional learning, that students are going to be much more successful, not just in social and emotional responses to issues like the COVID crisis, but it's going to equip them with the skill set to succeed in their studies, to succeed in the world of work, and to succeed in their lives beyond school as well.
Of course, there's been a huge amount of negative consequences of COVID-19. I don't want to go into all of them now because the list is probably too long for the amount of time we've got left. But let's talk about positives. And I know, Malcolm, you're very keen to talk about positives. What positives have you taken, first of all, personally, but also what positives have we taken as a society from everything that's happened this year?
Okay, well, perhaps quickly two. One is I thought it would be a good idea to find a new hobby during COVID-19. So by a bit of luck, I've got quite a large house and also quite a large workshop attached to it. So I've been restoring old Victorian writing boxes. And what I do is I give them to people who are suffering mentally, if you like, from COVID-19, and call them happy boxes. So for example, my twin brother has one, and he puts in that all the important details which he needs to have, social services and others can be aware of that. That has given me a huge, should we say, lift, because I feel I'm helping other people. I think the second point really is that we can learn positive results from around the world. And the slight danger is that we tend to only look very locally and tend to look within our own society. And there are lots and lots of examples. New Zealand's come up with some amazing, interesting stuff. some military people have come up with some pretty zany stuff, which maybe won't repeat. And Bill Gates has come up with some interesting ideas as well, but Bill tends to do that. So it's all there. We need to capture it.
What are Bill's ideas?
Well, I've had the privilege of talking to Bill Gates a couple of years ago when he was in London. He came for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. And I think what he's turned around, and Alexa is going to be far better explaining this than I am, is he's realised that technology is only a catalyst for society in general. And he's tried to look, I think, beyond that and see how we can benefit all of society, not just individuals, as we mentioned earlier, the technical geeks. And of course, he has the mechanisms available to him to do that, the money, the communication skills, and the background in technology. And I suppose if we can put all of that together and communicate it effectively, then we might be on a winning path.
Hermine, what positives have you taken, both personally and when looking outside the window and looking at society as a whole?
I think is a recognition that we can take a flexible approach to life, and that in adversity we can see it as an opportunity, and that maybe the lockdown was an opportunity for us to kind of reset, press the reset button, and to think differently about life and the things that bring us meaning. And for me, I've kind of I previously used to enjoy running kind of long distances and walking long distances, and decided, although they weren't having races anymore, that what I could do is set myself a challenge of walking or running 100 miles per month. And so I set myself that target, and with a group of friends, and got my niece involved in that. And so I guess the positive I take from it is that even though we may feel initially locked in by a circumstance, that it can unlock the opportunity for some new things to help us tune in to deeper meanings within ourselves, maybe spiritual ones, or about society and other people. And it can give us an opportunity to engage in activities that perhaps we wouldn't have had the time to do because we're so busy rushing about all the time.
I totally agree. I love your phrase, how we've realised we need a flexible approach to life. So there are definitely positives. I mean, Alexa, positives for you, both personally as well, and again, looking around.
Yeah, so I think for me it's been a little different because I have small children, so I don't feel like I had any more time, more like the opposite. And especially with having to homeschool them, and I live in Brussels, so I was homeschooling them in Dutch, which is not even my second language, it's more like my fourth language. So it was quite a challenge, but my Dutch definitely improved as a result, as well as my appreciation for how hard teachers work, which was already pretty high. I think, though, on the other hand, what was really rewarding for me and continues to be rewarding right now, even though the lockdown is somewhat lifted, is typically in my job, I travel extremely frequently. So actually being home with my children for much more time than I ever have been since maternity leave has been really wonderful. And it's been really great to see how they have dealt with all of the issues and the way that they've been just so resilient and creative in finding ways to change the way that they live and the way that they interact with their friends as well. So that's been a real positive for me. And then from a more professional standpoint, I think what's been amazing in the education world is that a lot of the traditional barriers between public and private sector have kind of broken down in terms of how we respond and how we work together more effectively. And I think there's much more trust and much more engagement across those two sectors. And so I was one of the team that set up the UNESCO Global Coalition for COVID Response in Education. And so I've been working really closely with countries like Senegal, like the Gambia, Cabo Verde, various countries in the Caribbean and Latin America to support them in deploying their remote and hybrid learning strategies. And knowing that we are thinking about how can we help not just today, but trying to build the foundation for more effective education systems in those countries as they evolve post-COVID as well. It's really been extremely rewarding to see all of that happening.
So my final question is quite a big one. Looking back on our discussion, we've talked about where we are and the kind of period of change that we've been going through. how we need to adapt both as individuals and communities, but also it hasn't all been doom and gloom. I'd like you to imagine that you've got every single world leader in front of you. I mean, I don't know who would like to jump in first, but what would you say to our leaders? What's the most important thing that our leaders should be concentrating on now? Or is it just, is it too difficult to boil it down to one?
Can I have a go at that?
I'd love you to.
I've met a few world leaders, including Donald Trump, because he has a property not too far from us at Prestwick. And I thought you might ask this question. So I've actually come up with a quote from J.R.R. Tolkien. There is some good in this world and it's worth fighting for. And I think that's probably the message I would give across to leaders, great and small, and also leaders in the community who are not yet acknowledged as leaders in the community. Because it's quite a good message that the world is worth fighting for.
Wonderful. Alexa?
So I spend a lot of time with decision makers as well, but obviously more than the education space. And so I think my call to action is that we need to make effort to reach out to those who are digitally excluded. We need to ensure that connectivity is affordable and easy for everybody, that they have access to devices that can help them play a role in society and continue learning and continue to be in touch with others. And so let's make an effort to make sure that we really connect everyone.
And Hermine?
I guess for me, I guess it comes to something a bit more existential, that life is more important than the economy. I remember at the very early stages of the pandemic, they interviewed a doctor working in Italy when they were undergoing a huge kind of crisis, and the hospitals were, you know, like just overwhelmed with the amount of people who were incredibly sick. And he said, why are people discussing the economy when people are dying? If everyone dies, there will be no economy. And so I think the idea of focusing on people's lives, the quality of people's lives, and it creating meaning and helping people to discover meaning within their lives is more important than seeing it as a battle between life and the economy. So that would be my kind of take on it.
Hermine Graham, Malcolm Waugh and Alexa Joyce, thank you ever so much for your time today. And best of luck dealing with our new normal.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Thanks very much, everybody.
Thank
nice
you.
To
it was
see
a pleasure.
You.
Great to
nice
meet
to see you.
All.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.